It's that time on the radio where we listen to Bill Blevins and Blevins Franks. Hi there, Bill.
Hi, Howard. How are you?
I'm very well. Well, let's have a chat today about what people should do with their savings once they've retired abroad. They may have cash in the bank from years of saving, or perhaps they're selling their UK property, perhaps they've got a business there to sell, or maybe they've got some investments which they've owned and collected, amassed for years. What should they do with all this capital now to protect it for their future and for their heirs?
Well, I think, you know, look, Howard, you made a very good point. I mean, pretty much everybody who comes to Blevins Franks as a potential client has got cash in the bank from years of saving. Many of them have sold UK properties and in many cases substantial businesses, and they've got investments they might have owned for years. And when you say what should they do with their capital now to protect it for the future, I think the key issue for most retired expatriates is to protect their capital. Of course, they want to make a decent return on their money, but they want to protect what they've worked hard to build up over their lifetime. I think the protection of an individual's capital and maintaining lifelong financial security are at the top of the list before you get down to how much income can you generate and how much can the capital grow by and how can we protect ourselves against tax and inflation and inheritance taxes, for example. First of all, you want to be protecting your capital. You know, those are the key ingredients, protecting your capital, then moving on to how you might generate an adequate and satisfactory income for life, and then about how your capital can earn its keep, making an acceptable level of performance in relation to an acceptable level of investment risk. And then, of course, at the end of that, looking how you can leave a healthy inheritance to your surviving spouse, children and grandchildren.
Those old proverbs are valid even now when you don't put all your eggs in one basket. Can we have a look at some of the key investment assets that people tend to hold in their portfolios? Shall we start with cash? Now, what's your advice on holding cash?
You can understand anyone's willingness to hold cash when it appears that whilst it's in the bank, it isn't actually at risk and most people feel safe with it. The money you hold on deposit in the bank doesn't drop suddenly based upon any number of geopolitical events, investor sentiment or a company's particular misfortunes. It is important, of course, to keep an adequate amount of cash within your investment holdings. It's a convenient and sometimes necessary liquid asset that you may need to access in an emergency. And in any event, it's a sensible part of an overall portfolio. But the problem is that most people shouldn't really keep too much savings in cash for the longer term, because inflation has exceeded the rate of return on cash deposits now for a decade or more. And that means that the value, the spending value of that capital has slowly been eroded. And, you know, whilst in the past, and we're talking pre 2008-2009, whilst in that period it was possible to rely on interest to earn an income from a bank deposit, that really hasn't been possible for the last 9 or 10 years because interest rates have been cut to such low levels.
Yeah. What about property, Bill? Is that a good investment option?
Well, an Englishman's home is his castle, so they say, and it's sometimes very comforting to know that you own property, either in the country in which you've chosen to live or in the country you came from. And investing in bricks and mortar can often seem like a solid investment, and it's an important part, I think, of everybody's overall portfolio when looked at in a holistic perspective. You know, but you need to remember that your dream home, wherever you're now living, forms part of your portfolio and potentially quite a large part of that portfolio. Some people use the expression overhoused and undercapitalized. Many people buy properties significantly in excess of the proportionate value it should have in their total investment portfolio. And if many people who do buy a second or third property, it can make you sort of overweight in that asset class. And that increases risk, however you look at it. If real estate prices do drop and people do say, well, that rarely happens. Well, you know, if you live in France or Spain or Portugal, and Cyprus to some more limited extent, if you live in any of those four countries, I can tell you that property prices have fallen significantly over the last 10 years. Howard, you'll know very well that properties have remained empty, and I mean, the market has picked up a bit in the last year or two, that is for sure. But properties fell significantly by as much as 50% during that period. So you do need to consider not overweighting your property your portfolio in property simply because it sounds like bricks and mortar is the thing to do. It's not always the case.
No. For our listeners in Spain then, Bill, let's move on to equities and bonds now. What role do they play in a portfolio, and what are the benefits and the risks?
Well, I think equities and bonds, and just to explain briefly what bonds are you, the investor, lending money to somebody. It can be a government bond, it can be a UK gilt, a US Treasury, and you are lending money to the government and you're pretty safe and secure, but of course the returns on that, because of the virtual nil risk scenario, you're going to be getting not much more than you would have got on cash deposit. You can also lend money to corporations, to substantial corporations, in the, let's for example say the FTSE 100, where your risk there is pretty limited and therefore your returns will be better than a government bond, but not as good as you lending money into a smaller company in, say, the FTSE 250 or even lower down the FTSE ladder. Because of the risk involved, you can often generate returns in excess of 8 or 9%, but then, of course, you're taking a higher level of risk. What matters is how much of each of those asset classes, equities, government bonds, corporate bonds, how much of those do you actually have in proportion in your portfolio? The best part of holding those asset classes is, of course, that they, if you have a range of different investments, they offer you the opportunity of capital growth. These assets can grow in value over time, and you can also structure the way in which you hold equities and bonds so that they are held within something which also produces a significant degree of successful tax planning. You can hold them in an investment bond, for example, which can provide massive tax advantages in pretty much every country throughout continental Europe, which maximises your returns. If you've got a roll-up of your equity and bond portfolio, which is entirely free of taxation, of course, you are in a position of maximising your returns. So it's important to know that you have a mixed class of assets so that they are in different areas of the market, so that they are in different denominated in different currencies, so that like the pistons of an engine, when one is up, another will be down maybe, but over time, and it is time that makes money and not timing, over time, there's no question, because the historical returns over a long, long time show that if you are invested in real assets, equities in particular, that they will grow exponentially faster than cash, and indeed faster than bonds in almost every case. And of course, you have to balance your portfolio with having blue chip equities and medium risk equities and higher risk equities in decreasing proportions to make sure that you're satisfied with the diversification and the risk that that generates in relation to the likely returns you're going to receive.
Okay. So how do you help your clients, Bill, determine how much of each asset class to include in their portfolios, and which companies to buy shares in?
Well, it's a complex set of circumstances. Within the Blevins Franks business, our business is really based upon a long-term relationship with every individual client. We don't have, a model range of clients. We treat each client as an individual. And the idea will be that in the fact-finding stage, when the client will sit with the independent and qualified financial advisor of Blevins Franks, we will be investigating the financial circumstances and a lot of other bits of personal data about the client to give us a picture that we are then going to go away and prepare a plan for, and then return with that plan to then discuss it further for fine-tuning and perhaps changing this and that to make sure it fits the bill. Because the arrangement that we're looking to produce is to make an investment portfolio and wealth management picture that fits you, rather than taking a fixed product and trying to squeeze you into it. That just simply doesn't work. That's like the difference between a ready-made suit, the one that you get fitted into, and the made-to-measure suit that fits you perfectly in all places after one or two or three fittings. It may be that the first report we write needs some adjustments because we may not get it all right first time. But then we wouldn't want to take action until we've got it totally right. So it may mean that having given us all the information, we may need to meet with you one or twice more, perhaps, before we get down to talking about putting anything into action. And of course, before Blevins Franks put any portfolio wealth management recommendation into action, you will know precisely in advance exactly how much it's going to cost to the penny, so that you aren't committed to doing anything without being fully aware of what your costs are going to be in relation to the benefits and advantages that recommendation can bring to you.
Okay. So, of course, investments are an important part of retirement planning here in Spain, but so is tax planning and estate planning. So which should be done first, or should people review all aspects of their financial planning at the same time?
Well, it's the latter, Howard. I keep using this term holistic financial planning, but I can't think of a better way of describing it. But it is to suggest holistic financial planning that in looking at, if you come to Blevins Franks and say, look, I'd like you to look at my pension, perhaps I'll give you this example, I'd like you to look at my pension, we will then say to you, would you mind if we can consider all of your other financial affairs so that we can create a picture into which we can fit the pensions part of it. We don't want to do something in isolation necessarily from the other areas of your financial planning, because we need them to fit together like a jigsaw. We need all the pieces to gel together in a formulaic way in which they work, as it were, to give you a 1 + 1 = 2 and a bit answer, and not do something over here which is contradicted by something you've got over here which we don't know about. So holistic financial planning and reviewing all your things at the same time creates the opportunity of getting a multiplier result to the overall wealth management program, including how you invest your money, where you invest your money, how much you keep in cash, what you should do with your pension, how that should all be structured to make it extremely tax efficient. All of that should be dealt with as one issue. And very often someone will come to Blevins Franks and say, I've got an investment portfolio. I'm thinking of appointing you as the investment advisor. Can you tell me what you might do with this? And as attractive as that is as a business proposition, it isn't really enough for us to simply act for that particular project in isolation from all the other things. If we do, we may not be doing the best job for you. We don't necessarily need to change the other things that you've got, but knowing about them allows us to produce the best result for the particular area of your financial planning that you're asking us to advise on.
Yeah. Well, how can people get in touch with Blevins Franks then, Bill?
I think if you go to the website in the first place at www.blevinsfranks.com, you'll find, as I say, a list of all the local offices close to where you live. There will be an office for sure. You'll be contacting people who live in Spain in the same way that you live in Spain. They are qualified to give advice and they're regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority of the United Kingdom. So you can be sure you're going to get good advice. They'd love to hear from you.
We'll talk again at the same time next week, Bill. Thank you very much.
Sure. Take care, Howard. Have a good week.